The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day. This week, Harold Nicholson, biographer, and A.J.P. Taylor, historian, discuss the question of how history should be written. Alan Taylor speaks first.
Well, the writing of history is a big subject. I suppose we're right to put the emphasis that way. The historian's problem is the writing, isn't it? But I wonder which part of the writing is the important one. Is it, do you think, Nicholson, that it's the work, the research, or the presentation, the shaping of it that really matters? Do you think history is a science or an art?
Well, obviously, the research is of almost vital importance. But it must be produced in some readable and convincing form. After all, the point of any book of any sort is communication. And unless you're able to communicate something to your reader, you're not communicating any real thought or creating any real impression. And therefore, I believe that although research is the stuff which history is made, I think presentation is enormously important.
Yes, I think a lot of historians forget that one purpose, at any rate, of writing a book is that someone should read it. What do you suppose that people meant when they said that history was a science?
I suppose, I don't know, Taylor, but I imagine that the people who said that were Germans.
who imagined, that if you accumulated a sufficient number of facts accurately and in the correct order, that then you were conveying an idea. On the other hand, the French historians, who always start with an idea first and then fit the material in, were more concerned with trying to create what they would have called, I think Michelet would have said quite definitely, a work of art. And I think that the truth lies somewhere between the German theory and the French theory, don't you?
Yes, I think, Nicholson, that may be true, of course, in politics as well as in history. It's certainly true that the Germans imagined that they were writing scientific history. You remember Ranke's phrase that he sought to present the past as it really had been. And the way he thought he was doing it was always to be running after extra documents. The most extraordinary thing that in Ranke, who is the greatest example of that kind of historian, that one gets the impression from him that he genuinely believed that just round the corner was the final explanation. That if he could get one more document, everything would fall into place, and that he'd know exactly why something had happened in the year 1525.
Yes, but of course, again, I know you'll agree with me that after all, history, or let us call it politics, at different stages of development, is a question of human personality and not a question of documents. I mean, my experience on the few occasions in which I've seen history being made, which I have sometimes, is that I have sat back, watched these things, conferences and things, and I have thought to myself, now the historian won't get this right at all, because I know very well that Monsieur Clemenceau wants to go out to luncheon and he's hurrying this thing. And I know that President Wilson's feeling tired and very exhausted and has got the cramps and wants to finish it all. And those tiny little elements of human weakness or incapacity do play an enormous part in the actual sequence of events. And again, if I may just say something more, because I'd like your view on this, Taylor. I feel, reading history, that after all, the historian is talking after the event. And he sees documents, he sees results, and he imagines those results were intended. Well, I must say, my experience is that things do not occur because, or very seldom occur because they were intended. They generally occur in a fit of absence of mind.
Yes, I'd agree with you in some ways, Damir. Nicholson, I'm sure that system-making is a disease of the historian. It's because we have so much ground to cover and so little space to cover it in. We've got to simplify. I'd agree with you too, Nicholson, that the little unexpected event, the small and quite trivial thing that can never be recorded, is something that historians got to weigh, and I'd say that any good historian does weigh. On the other hand, you take an illustration from war. War seems, if you read the account, shall we say, in the trenches, a matter of trivialities. And, shall we say, in the campaign of 1940, I dare say there were many trivialities and occasions on which French units defeated German units. But surely there's also a bigger pattern. And the historian is quite right who would describe that bigger pattern of the campaign of 1940, in which, despite the occasional accident, the occasional German blunder, the occasional French recovery, the great pattern was of an overwhelming military disaster which the French suffered, which was inflicted by the German army. And isn't that true even, shall we say, in the Treaty of Versailles, that despite what Clemenceau wanted to do or Wilson wanted to do, one is entitled to talk about a Wilsonian system of ideas, shall we say, which shaped a great part of the treaty. And as against this, a French policy of greater realism, of looking after French interests, which modified this system of ideas.
Yes, then I think that's true. I do think that's true. I mean, I think it is true that it was a conflict, very much a conflict between we call idealism and realism, which resulted in a very unfortunate compromise. And I think that's true because, after all, your analogy of war, the ordinary individual taking part in the battle, as we all know, has no conception of what's going on, and yet there is a pattern at the end. But I do believe that it is a danger for the historian always to assume, to exaggerate purpose, intention.
Yes, I think that's a different matter. Or rather, I put it in a slightly different way, Nicholson, that the purpose of the statesman or even of the general is a very different thing from his achievement. I think the historian ought surely to bring in purpose and say the statesman was trying to do so. The vision which he had, the project which he had in mind was of such a character. And at the same time, to appreciate that this is very different indeed from the finished product. That's
yes.
The essential thing.
Then now, there's another point I'd like to ask you, because it's always fascinated me. Do you believe that history or the events of the world are determined by great unseen movements, by some process of determinism? Or do you believe that individuals can really alter the course of history? My own view, I'll tell you, and you can throw it down, is that it's very rare that individuals really affect it. I mean, you can say Napoleon did, or Bismarck did, or Hitler did, but that they're very exceptional. And that it's generally the ordinary person that we know or are familiar with in our politics or in our history. Cromwell did, but generally it's events that determine men's actions, not men that determine events. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think I would, on the whole. There's no doubt, as you say, that the occasional great man who occurs at the right moment, as it were, that he counts a very great deal. The history of our century would have been very different without Lenin. I would say Napoleon, Bismarck, Lenin are the three who pulled our modern history almost out of step, as it were.
Yeah.
But I'd also agree on the whole that the whole pattern of society, its economic developments, its religious outlook, its judgments on morals, on the things that are worthwhile and so on, that these are the things which must shape history, and the great problem for the historian is how to bring this down to earth, how to relate these vague social and moral and intellectual forces to the actual practical facts, to show that this is the way in which history is made. You and I, we don't feel enormously affected by the ideas of our time, and yet we're quite aware, if we really analyze it, that it is the ideas of our generation.
Yes, I think so, Ted. I mean, I think that the ideas of our time, as you say, we're not conscious of them exactly, but they become the furniture of our minds. Mm. They are there. They're in our brains. But, therefore, should the historian, as after all we're talking about, should he write on a theme? Should he say the spirit of the age, that very vague and misleading expression, was this or that? And people were guided and influenced by this spirit in a way which they were quite unconscious of. And that therefore it's the spirit of the age that you must determine, and not the efforts and ambitions and jealousies and weaknesses of individuals.
Well, I think...
Do you believe in the spirit of the age?
Well, yes, I think it's something the historian has, the climate, has to allow for, and it's one of the, it's the great problems. The really great artists who've been historians are those who've been able to make one feel from taking individual examples that there was something that's called the climate of the age. But I would say, on the other hand, that it's extremely important for the historian to remember, when he talks about the climate of the age, the spirit of the age, that there is no such thing, that there are a great number of individuals who shade in together, but who are different as individuals. That's why I'm always very hesitant to accept the sort of historian who can see in everything a planned working out of a system, and who can take, should we say, a single class and say, here we, this is what the working class feels, or who can talk about a single civilization. That I think when you get as far as that, you do tend to forget that these are human beings that you deal with all kinds of variations.
You would say, for instance, would you, Taylor, that a book, I think a very great book, and certainly a very delightful book, like Toynbee's study of history, that it erred, if it erred at all, in making too symmetrical a pattern of various states of civilization.
Well, I must say, I certainly find the pattern much clearer and more defined than I could accept. That I would agree with you, a delightful book, a book in which the, as it were, the illustrations are more effective than the things which they're put in to prove. When I'm asked to accept that there have been so many civilizations and that they all move in a given way, that a certain time a civilization begins to decline, a certain other time it becomes rigid and so on, I don't believe that men are so shaped and forced into a mold.
Or that history is so recurrent.
Oh, no. That also.
Yes, I rather agree with you. But then, on the other hand, there is the fact that a historian, as I said at the beginning, if he's going to communicate anything, if he's going to leave any impression on his reader, he must have a theme. I mean, sometimes there are, I think, very bad themes, like Michelet with the Romanticism. I mean, that was bad history. But I should imagine that there's very few historians who write a book, and after all, it's a tremendous labour, who don't have, let's call it a theme, but let's call it a point of view. And they have their sympathies and their antipathies, and that creates, as we see with Macaulay, a certain state of mind in which they think certain things were good, certain things were bad, and that the good triumphed, and that the people who furthered the good, were noble people, and the people who obstructed the good were very evil and wicked and stupid. Well, of course, I don't think it's quite true, but I think it's inevitable.
I think it's inevitable. I find it difficult to believe that anyone, as you say, can embark on this enormous task. And any form of historical research is an enormous task, and may well prove an unrewarding one, without some point of view. I think it's true from my own modest experience that one's point of view may change when you're writing your book. Either that the material may turn out to be rather different from what you've expected, or that the sort of experience you get while you're writing it may be such as to change your point of view. But I think you end up with a point of view just the same. I be prepared to say that Macaulay's point of view on many things, on, shall we say, on Marlborough's character, on the character of William III, was probably a good deal modified by the work that he put in, that when he came to the end, he was by no means the same person as he had been at the beginning. But I think a point of view remained. And I always regard with the greatest distrust the historian who claims to be detached completely, as it were, above any feeling for human behaviour, who calls himself impartial. But in fact, it seems to me that impartiality is the most dangerous form, really, of taking sides, because it has this air of misleading superiority.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, but of course, I mean, we're assuming great integrity in scholarship.
Oh, is
that all that?
I mean, yes.
No falsification of fact. But I often wonder whether people who haven't gone through the tremendous labour of accumulating and digesting and presenting material realise that that would be quite impossible